Antenna gate. Design versus engineering. In many consumer product companies, there's tension between the designers, who want to make a product look beautiful, and the engineers, who need to make sure it fulfills its functional requirements. At Apple, where Jobs pushed both design and engineering to the edge, that tension was even greater. When he and design director Johnny Ive became creative co-conspirators back in 1997, they tended to view the qualms expressed by engineers as evidence of a can't-do attitude that needed to be overcome. Their faith that awesome design could force superhuman feats of engineering was reinforced by the success of the iMac and iPod. When engineers said something couldn't be done, Ive and Jobs pushed them to try, and usually they succeeded. There were occasional small problems. The iPod Nano, for example, was prone to getting scratched because Ive believed that a clear coating would lessen the purity of his design. But that was not a crisis. When it came to designing the iPhone, Ive's design desires bumped into a fundamental law of physics that could not be changed even by a reality distortion field. Metal is not a great material to put near an antenna. As Michael Faraday showed, electromagnetic waves flow around the surface of metal, not through it. So a metal enclosure around a phone can create what is known as a Faraday cage, diminishing the signals that get in or out. The original iPhone started with a plastic band at the bottom, but Ive thought that would wreck the design integrity and asked that there be an aluminum rim all around. After that ended up working out, Ive designed the iPhone 4 with a steel rim. The steel would be the structural support, look really sleek, and serve as part of the phone's antenna. There were significant challenges. In order to serve as an antenna, the steel rim had to have a tiny gap. But if a person covered that gap with a finger or sweaty palm, there could be some signal loss. The engineers suggested a clear coating over the metal to help prevent this, but again, I felt that this would detract from the brushed metal look. The issue was presented to Jobs at various meetings, but he thought the engineers were crying wolf. "You can make this work," he said. And so they did. And it worked, almost perfectly, but not totally perfectly. When the iPhone 4 was released in June 2010, it looked awesome. But a problem soon became evident. If you held the phone a certain way, especially using your left hand so your palm covered the tiny gap, you could lose your connection. It occurred with perhaps 1 in 100 calls. Because Jobs insisted on keeping his unreleased products secret, even the phone that Gizmodo scored in a bar had a fake case around it, the iPhone 4 did not go through the live testing that most electronic devices get. So the flaw was not caught before the massive rush to buy it began. The question is whether the twin policies of putting design in front of engineering and having a policy of super secrecy surrounding unreleased products helped Apple. Tony Fadell said later, "On the whole, yes. But unchecked power is a bad thing, and that's what happened." Had it not been the Apple iPhone 4, a product that had everyone transfixed, the issue of a few extra dropped calls would not have made news. But it became known as Antenna Gate, and it boiled to a head in early July when Consumer Reports did some rigorous tests and said that it could not recommend the iPhone 4 because of the antenna problem. Jobs was in Kona Village, Hawaii, with his family when the issue arose. At first, he was defensive. Art Levinson was in constant contact by phone, and Jobs insisted that the problem stemmed from Google and Motorola making mischief. "They want to shoot Apple down," he said. Levinson urged a little humility. Let's try to figure out if there's something wrong, he said. When he again mentioned the perception that Apple was arrogant, Jobs didn't like it. It went against his black-white, right-wrong way of viewing the world. Apple was a company of principle, he felt. If others failed to see that, it was their fault, not a reason for Apple to play humble. Jobs's second reaction was to be hurt. He took the criticism personally and became emotionally anguished. At his core, he doesn't do things that he thinks are blatantly wrong, like some pure pragmatists in our business, Levinson said. So if he feels he's right, he will just charge ahead rather than question himself. Levinson urged him not to get depressed, but Jobs did. Fuck this. It's not worth it, he told Levinson. Finally, Tim Cook was able to shake him out of his lethargy. He quoted someone as saying that Apple was becoming the new Microsoft, complacent and arrogant. The next day, Jobs changed his attitude. Let's get to the bottom of this, he said. When the data about dropped calls were assembled from AT&T, Jobs realized there was a problem, even if it was more minor than people were making it seem. So he flew back from Hawaii, but before he left, he made some phone calls. It was time to gather a couple of trusted old hands, wise men who had been with him during the original Macintosh days 30 years earlier. His first call was to Regis McKenna, the public relations guru. I'm coming back from Hawaii to deal with this antenna thing, and I need to bounce some stuff off of you, Jobs told him. They agreed to meet at the Cupertino boardroom at 1:30 the next afternoon. The second call was to the ad man, Lee Clow. He had tried to retire from the Apple account, but Jobs liked having him around. His colleague James Vincent was summoned as well. Jobs also decided to bring his son Reed, then a high school senior, back with him from Hawaii. I'm going to be in meetings 24/7 for probably 2 days, and I want you to be in every single one, because you'll learn more in those 2 days than you would in 2 years at business school, he told him. You're going to be in the room with the best people in the world making really tough decisions and get to see how the sausage is made. Jobs got a little misty-eyed when he recalled the experience. I would go through that all again just for that opportunity to have him see me at work, he said. He got to see what his dad does. They were joined by Katie Cotton, the steady public relations chief at Apple, and 7 other top executives. The meeting lasted all afternoon. It was one of the greatest meetings of my life, Jobs later said. He began by laying out all the data they had gathered. Here are the facts, so what should we do about it? McKenna was the most calm and straightforward. Just lay out the truth, the data, he said. Don't appear arrogant, but appear firm and confident. Others, including Vincent, pushed Jobs to be more apologetic, but McKenna said no. Don't go into the press conference with your tail between your legs, he advised. You should just say, phones aren't perfect, and we're not perfect. We're human, and doing the best we can, and here's the data. That became the strategy. When the topic turned to the perception of arrogance, McKenna urged him not to worry too much. I don't think it would work to try to make Steve look humble, McKenna explained later. As Steve says about himself, what you see is what you get. At the press event that Friday, held in Apple's auditorium, Jobs followed McKenna's advice. He did not grovel or apologize, yet he was able to diffuse the problem by showing that Apple understood it and would try to make it right. Then he changed the framework of the discussion, saying that all cell phones had some problems. Later he told me that he had sounded a bit too annoyed at the event, but in fact he was able to strike a tone that was unemotional and straightforward. He captured it in 4 short declarative sentences. We're not perfect. Phones are not perfect. We all know that. But we want to make our users happy. If anyone was unhappy, he said, they could return the phone. The return rate turned out to be 1.7%, less than a third of the return rate for the iPhone 3GS or most other phones, or get a free bumper case from Apple. He went on to report data showing that other mobile phones had similar problems. That was not totally true. Apple's antenna design made it slightly worse than most other phones, including earlier versions of the iPhone. But it was true that the media frenzy over the iPhone 4's dropped calls was overblown. This is blown so out of proportion that it's incredible, he said. Instead of being appalled that he didn't grovel or order a recall, most customers realized that he was right. The wait list for the phone, which was already sold out, went from 2 weeks to 3. It remained the company's fastest-selling product ever. The media debate shifted to the issue of whether Jobs was right to assert that other smartphones had the same antenna problems. Even if the answer was no, that was a better story to face than one about whether the iPhone 4 was a defective dud. Some media observers were incredulous. In a bravura demonstration of stonewalling, righteousness, and hurt sincerity, Steve Jobs successfully took to the stage the other day to deny the problem, dismiss the criticism, and spread the blame among other smartphone makers. Michael Wolff of Newser.com wrote, "This is a level of modern marketing, corporate spin, and crisis management about which you can only ask with stupefied incredulity and awe, how do they get away with it? Or more accurately, how does he get away with it?" Wolff attributed it to Jobs's mesmerizing effect as the last charismatic individual. Other CEOs would be offering abject apologies and swallowing massive recalls, but Jobs didn't have to. The grim, skeletal appearance, the absolutism, the ecclesiastical bearing, the sense of his relationship with the sacred really works, and in this instance, allows him the privilege of magisterially deciding what is meaningful and what is trivial. Scott Adams, the creator of the cartoon strip Dilbert, was also incredulous, but far more admiring. He wrote a blog entry a few days later, which Jobs proudly emailed around, that marveled at how Jobs's high ground maneuver was destined to be studied as a new public relations standard. Apple's response to the iPhone 4 problem didn't follow the public relations playbook because Jobs decided to rewrite the playbook, Adams wrote. If you want to know what genius looks like, study Jobs's words. By proclaiming up front that phones are not perfect, Jobs changed the context of the argument with an indisputable assertion. If Jobs had not changed the context from the iPhone 4 to all smartphones in general, I could make you a hilarious comic strip about a product so poorly made that it won't work if it comes in contact with a human hand. But as soon as the context is changed to all smartphones have problems, the humor opportunity is gone. Nothing kills humor like a general and boring truth. Here comes the sun. There were a few things that needed to be resolved for the career of Steve Jobs to be complete. Among them was an end to the 30 years war with the band he loved, the Beatles. In 2007, Apple had settled its trademark battle with Apple Corp., the holding company of the Beatles, which had first sued the fledgling computer company over use of the name in 1978. But that still did not get the Beatles into the iTunes store. The band was the last major holdout, primarily because it had not resolved with EMI Music, which owned most of its songs, how to handle the digital rights. By the summer of 2010, the Beatles and EMI had sorted things out, and a four-person summit was held in the boardroom in Cupertino. Jobs and his vice president for the iTunes store, Eddie Q, played host to Jeff Jones, who managed the Beatles' interests, and Roger Faxon, the chief of EMI Music. Now that the Beatles were ready to go digital, what could Apple offer to make that milestone special? Jobs had been anticipating this day for a long time. In fact, he and his advertising team, Lee Clow and James Vincent, had mocked up some ads and commercials 3 years earlier when strategizing on how to lure the Beatles on board. "Steve and I thought about all the things that we could possibly do," Q recalled. "That included taking over the front page of the iTunes store, buying billboards featuring the best photographs of the band, and running a series of television ads in classic Apple style. The topper was offering a $149 box set that included all 13 Beatles studio albums, the two-volume Past Masters collection, and a nostalgia-inducing video of the 1964 Washington Coliseum concert." Once they reached an agreement in principle, Jobs personally helped choose the photographs for the ads. Each commercial ended with a still black-and-white shot of Paul McCartney and John Lennon, young and smiling, in a recording studio looking down at a piece of music. It evoked the old photographs of Jobs and Wozniak looking at an Apple circuit board. "Getting the Beatles on iTunes was the culmination of why we got into the music business," said Q. Chapter 40. To Infinity. The Cloud, the Spaceship, and Beyond. The iPad 2. Even before the iPad went on sale, Jobs was thinking about what should be in the iPad 2. It needed front and back cameras, everyone knew that was coming, and he definitely wanted it to be thinner. But there was a peripheral issue that he focused on that most people hadn't thought about. The cases that people used covered the beautiful lines of the iPad and detracted from the screen. They made fatter what should be thinner. They put a pedestrian cloak on a device that should be magical in all of its aspects. Around that time, he read an article about magnets, cut it out, and handed it to Johnny Ive. The magnets had a cone of attraction that could be precisely focused. Perhaps they could be used to align a detachable cover. That way, it could snap onto the front of an iPad, but not have to engulf the entire device. One of the guys in Ive's group worked out how to make a detachable cover that could connect with a magnetic hinge. When you began to open it, the screen would pop to life like the face of a tickled baby, and then the cover could fold into a stand. It was not high-tech, it was purely mechanical, but it was enchanting. It also was another example of Jobs' desire for end-to-end integration. The cover and the iPad had been designed together, so that the magnets and hinge all connected seamlessly. The iPad 2 would have many improvements, but this cheeky little cover, which most other CEOs would never have bothered with, was the one that would elicit the most smiles. Because Jobs was on another medical leave, he was not expected to be at the launch of the iPad 2, scheduled for March 2, 2011, in San Francisco. But when the invitations were sent out, he told me that I should try to be there. It was the usual scene: top Apple executives in the front row, Tim Cook eating energy bars, and the sound system blaring the appropriate Beatles songs, building up to "You Say You Want a Revolution" and "Here Comes the Sun." Reed Jobs arrived at the last minute with two rather wide-eyed freshman dorm mates. "We've been working on this product for a while, and I just didn't want to miss today," Jobs said as he ambled on stage, looking scarily gaunt, but with a jaunty smile. The crowd erupted in whoops, hollers, and a standing ovation. He began his demo of the iPad 2 by showing off the new cover. This time, the case and the product were designed together, he explained. Then he moved on to address a criticism that had been rankling him because it had some merit. The original iPad had been better at consuming content than at creating it. So Apple had adapted its two best creative applications for the Macintosh, GarageBand and iMovie, and made powerful versions available for the iPad. Jobs showed how easy it was to compose and orchestrate a song or put music and special effects into your home videos and post or share such creations using the new iPad. Once again, he ended his presentation with a slide showing the intersection of Liberal Arts Street and Technology Street. And this time, he gave one of the clearest expressions of his credo, that true creativity and simplicity comes from integrating the whole widget, hardware and software, and for that matter, content and covers and sales clerks, rather than allowing things to be open and fragmented, as happened in the world of Windows PCs and was now happening with Android devices. It's in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough. We believe that it's technology married with the humanities that yields us the result that makes our hearts sing. Nowhere is that more true than in these post-PC devices. Folks are rushing into this tablet market, and they're looking at it as the next PC, in which the hardware and the software are done by different companies. Our experience, and every bone in our body, says that is not the right approach. These are post-PC devices that need to be even more intuitive and easier to use than a PC, and where the software and the hardware and the applications need to be intertwined in an even more seamless way than they are on a PC. We think we have the right architecture, not just in silicon, but in our organization, to build these kinds of products. It was an architecture that was bred not just into the organization he had built, but into his own soul. After the launch event, Jobs was energized. He came to the Four Seasons Hotel to join me, his wife, and Reed, plus Reed's two Stanford pals for lunch. For a change, he was eating, though still with some pickiness. He ordered fresh-squeezed juice, which he sent back three times, declaring that each new offering was from a bottle, and a pasta primavera, which he shoved away as inedible after one taste. But then he ate half of my Crab Louie salad and ordered a full one for himself, followed by a bowl of ice cream. The indulgent hotel was even able to produce a glass of juice that finally met his standards. At his house the following day, he was still on a high. He was planning to fly to Kona Village the next day, alone, and I asked to see what he had put on his iPad 2 for the trip. There were three movies, Chinatown, The Bourne Ultimatum, and Toy Story 3. More revealingly, there was just one book that he had downloaded, The Autobiography of a Yogi, The Guide to Meditation and Spirituality, that he had first read as a teenager, then reread in India, and had read once a year ever since. Midway through the morning, he decided he wanted to eat something. He was still too weak to drive, so I drove him to a cafe in a shopping mall. It was closed, but the owner was used to Jobs knocking on the door at off hours, and he happily let us in. "He's taken on a mission to try to fatten me up," Jobs joked. His doctors had pushed him to eat eggs as a source of high-quality protein, and he ordered an omelet. Living with a disease like this, and all the pain, constantly reminds you of your own mortality, and that can do strange things to your brain if you're not careful, he said. You don't make plans more than a year out, and that's bad. You need to force yourself to plan as if you will live for many years. An example of this magical thinking was his plan to build a luxurious yacht. Before his liver transplant, he and his family used to rent a boat for vacations, traveling to Mexico, the South Pacific, or the Mediterranean. On many of these cruises, Jobs got bored or began to hate the design of the boat, so they would cut the trip short and fly to Kona Village. But sometimes the cruise worked well. "The best vacation I've ever been on was when we went down the coast of Italy, then to Athens, which is a pit, but the Parthenon is mind-blowing, and then to Ephesus in Turkey, where they have these ancient public lavatories in marble with a place in the middle for musicians to serenade." When they got to Istanbul, he hired a history professor to give his family a tour. At the end, they went to a Turkish bath, where the professor's lecture gave Jobs an insight about the globalization of youth. "I had a real revelation. We were all in robes, and they made some Turkish coffee for us. The professor explained how the coffee was made very different from anywhere else, and I realized, so fucking what? Which kids, even in Turkey, give a shit about Turkish coffee? All day I had looked at young people in Istanbul. They were all drinking what every other kid in the world drinks, and they were wearing clothes that looked like they were bought at the Gap, and they are all using cell phones. They were like kids everywhere else. It hit me that for young people, this whole world is the same now. When we're making products, there is no such thing as a Turkish phone or a music player that young people in Turkey would want that's different from one young people elsewhere would want. We're just one world now." After the joy of that cruise, Jobs had amused himself by beginning to design and then repeatedly redesigning a boat he said he wanted to build someday. When he got sick again in 2009, he almost canceled the project. "I didn't think I would be alive when it got done," he recalled. "But that made me so sad, and I decided that working on the design was fun to do, and maybe I have a shot at being alive when it's done. If I stop work on the boat, and then I make it alive for another 2 years, I would be really pissed. So I've kept going." After our omelets at the cafe, we went back to his house, and he showed me all of the models and architectural drawings. As expected, the planned yacht was sleek and minimalist. The teak decks were perfectly flat and unblemished by any accoutrements. As at an Apple store, the cabin windows were large panes, almost floor to ceiling, and the main living area was designed to have walls of glass that were 40 feet long and 10 feet high. He had gotten the chief engineer of the Apple stores to design a special glass that would be able to provide structural support. By then, the boat was under construction by the Dutch custom yacht builders, Fadeship, but Jobs was still fiddling with the design. "I know that it's possible I will die and leave Laureen with a half-built boat," he said, "but I have to keep going on it. If I don't, it's an admission that I'm about to die." He and Powell would be celebrating their 20th wedding anniversary a few days later, and he admitted that at times he had not been as appreciative of her as she deserved. "I'm very lucky, because you just don't know what you're getting into when you get married," he said. "You have an intuitive feeling about things. I couldn't have done better, because not only is Laureen smart and beautiful, she's turned out to be a really good person." For a moment, he teared up. He talked about his other girlfriends, particularly Tina Redsey, but said he ended up in the right place. He also reflected on how selfish and demanding he could be. "Laureen had to deal with that, and also with me being sick," he said. "I know that living with me is not a bowl of cherries." Among his selfish traits was that he tended not to remember anniversaries or birthdays. But in this case, he decided to plan a surprise. They had gotten married at the Awani Hotel in Yosemite, and he decided to take Powell back there on their anniversary. But when Jobs called, the place was fully booked. So he had the hotel approach the people who had reserved the suite where he and Powell had stayed and ask if they would relinquish it. "I offered to pay for another weekend," Jobs recalled, "and the man was very nice and said, 20 years? Please take it. It's yours." He found the photographs of the wedding taken by a friend and had large prints made on thick paper boards and placed in an elegant box. Scrolling through his iPhone, he found the note that he had composed to be included in the box and read it aloud. "We didn't know much about each other 20 years ago. We were guided by our intuition. You swept me off my feet. It was snowing when we got married at the Awani. Years passed, kids came, good times, hard times, but never bad times. Our love and respect has endured and grown. We've been through so much together, and here we are right back where we started 20 years ago, older, wiser, with wrinkles on our faces and hearts. We now know many of life's joys, sufferings, secrets, and wonders, and we're still here together. My feet have never returned to the ground." By the end of the recitation, he was crying uncontrollably. When he composed himself, he noted that he had also made a set of the pictures for each of his kids. "I thought they might like to see that I was young once." iCloud. In 2001, Jobs had a vision. Your personal computer would serve as a digital hub for a variety of lifestyle devices, such as music players, video recorders, phones, and tablets. This played to Apple's strength of creating end-to-end products that were simple to use. The company was thus transformed from a high-end niche computer company to the most valuable technology company in the world. By 2008, Jobs had developed a vision for the next wave of the digital era. In the future, he believed, your desktop computer would no longer serve as the hub for your content. Instead, the hub would move to the cloud. In other words, your content would be stored on remote servers managed by a company you trusted, and it would be available for you to use on any device, anywhere. It would take him 3 years to get it right. He began with a false step. In the summer of 2008, he launched a product called Mobile Me, an expensive $99 per year subscription service that allowed you to store your address book, documents, pictures, videos, email, and calendar remotely in the cloud and to sync them with any device. In theory, you could go to your iPhone or any computer and access all aspects of your digital life. There was, however, a big problem. The service, to use Jobs's terminology, sucked. It was complex, devices didn't sync well, and email and other data got lost randomly in the ether. "Apple's Mobile Me is far too flawed to be reliable," was the headline on Walt Mossberg's review in the Wall Street Journal. Jobs was furious. He gathered the Mobile Me team in the auditorium on the Apple campus, stood on stage, and asked, "Can anyone tell me what Mobile Me is supposed to do?" After the team members offered their answers, Jobs shot back, "So why the fuck doesn't it do that?" Over the next half hour, he continued to berate them. "You've tarnished Apple's reputation," he said. "You should hate each other for having let each other down. Mossberg, our friend, is no longer writing good things about us." In front of the whole audience, he got rid of the leader of the Mobile Me team and replaced him with Eddie Q, who oversaw all internet content at Apple. As Fortune's Adam Leshinsky reported in a dissection of the Apple corporate culture, accountability is strictly enforced. By 2010, it was clear that Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and others were aiming to be the company that could best store all of your content and data in the cloud and sync it on your various devices. So Jobs redoubled his efforts. As he explained it to me that fall, "We need to be the company that manages your relationship with the cloud, streams your music and videos from the cloud, stores your pictures and information, and maybe even your medical data." Apple was the first to have the insight about your computer becoming a digital hub. So we wrote all of these apps, iPhoto, iMovie, iTunes, and tied in our devices, like the iPod, an iPhone, an iPad, and it's worked brilliantly. But over the next few years, the hub is going to move from your computer into the cloud. So it's the same digital hub strategy, but the hub's in a different place. It means you will always have access to your content and you won't have to sync. It's important that we make this transformation because of what Clayton Christensen calls the innovator's dilemma, where people who invent something are usually the last ones to see past it, and we certainly don't want to be left behind. I'm going to take Mobile Me and make it free, and we're going to make syncing content simple. We are building a server farm in North Carolina. We can provide all the syncing you need, and that way we can lock in the customer. Jobs discussed this vision at his Monday morning meetings, and gradually it was refined to a new strategy. "I sent emails to groups of people at 2 a.m. and batted things around," he recalled. "We think about this a lot because it's not a job, it's our life." Although some board members, including Al Gore, questioned the idea of making Mobile Me free, they supported it. It would be their strategy for attracting customers into Apple's orbit for the next decade. The new service was named iCloud, and Jobs unveiled it in his keynote address to Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference in June 2011. He was still on medical leave, and for some days in May had been hospitalized with infections and pain. Some close friends urged him not to make the presentation, which would involve lots of preparation and rehearsals. But the prospect of ushering in another tectonic shift in the digital age seemed to energize him. When he came on stage at the San Francisco Convention Center, he was wearing a Von Rosen black cashmere sweater on top of his usual Issey Miyake black turtleneck, and he had thermal underwear beneath his blue jeans. But he looked more gaunt than ever. The crowd gave him a prolonged standing ovation. "That always helps, and I appreciate it," he said. But within minutes, Apple's stock dropped more than $4 to $340. He was making a heroic effort, but he looked weak. He handed the stage over to Phil Schiller and Scott Forstall to demo the new operating systems for Macs and mobile devices, then came back on to show off iCloud himself. "About 10 years ago, we had one of our most important insights," he said. "The PC was going to become the hub for your digital life, your videos, your photos, your music. But it has broken down in the last few years. Why?" He riffed about how hard it was to get all of your content synced to each of your devices. If you have a song you've downloaded on your iPad, a picture you've taken on your iPhone, and a video you've stored on your computer, you can end up feeling like an old-fashioned switchboard operator as you plug USB cables in and out of things to get the content shared. "Keeping these devices in sync is driving us crazy," he said to great laughter. "We have a solution. It's our next big insight. We are going to demote the PC and the Mac to be just a device, and we are going to move the digital hub into the cloud." Jobs was well aware that this big insight was in fact not really new. Indeed, he joked about Apple's previous attempt. "You may think, why should I believe them? They're the ones who brought me Mobile Me." The audience laughed nervously. Let me just say, it wasn't our finest hour. but as he demonstrated iCloud, it was clear that it would be better. Mail, contacts, and calendar entries synced instantly. So did apps, photos, books, and documents. Most impressive, Jobs and Eddie Q had made deals with the music companies, unlike the folks at Google and Amazon. Apple would have 18 million songs on its cloud servers. If you had any of these on any of your devices or computers, whether you had bought it legally or pirated it, Apple would let you access a high-quality version of it on all of your devices without having to go through the time and effort to upload it to the cloud. "It all just works," he said. That simple concept, that everything would just work seamlessly, was, as always, Apple's competitive advantage. Microsoft had been advertising cloud power for more than a year, and 3 years earlier, its chief software architect, the legendary Ray Ozzie, had issued a rallying cry to the company. "Our aspiration is that individuals will only need to license their media once and use any of their devices to access and enjoy their media." But Ozzie had quit Microsoft at the end of 2010, and the company's cloud computing push was never manifested in consumer devices. Amazon and Google both offered cloud services in 2011, but neither company had the ability to integrate the hardware and software and content of a variety of devices. Apple controlled every link in the chain and designed them all to work together. The devices, computers, operating systems, and application software, along with the sale and storage of the content. Of course, it worked seamlessly only if you were using an Apple device and stayed within Apple's gated garden. That produced another benefit for Apple: customer stickiness. Once you began using iCloud, it would be difficult to switch to a Kindle or Android device. Your music and other content would not sync to them. In fact, they might not even work. It was the culmination of 3 decades spent eschewing open systems. "We thought about whether we should do a music client for Android," Jobs told me over breakfast the next morning. "We put iTunes on Windows in order to sell more iPods, but I don't see an advantage of putting our music app on Android, except to make Android users happy, and I don't want to make Android users happy." A new campus. When Jobs was 13, he had looked up Bill Hewlett in the phone book, called him to score a part he needed for a frequency counter he was trying to build, and ended up getting a summer job at the instruments division of Hewlett-Packard. That same year, HP bought some land in Cupertino to expand its calculator division. Wozniak went to work there, and it was on this site that he designed the Apple I and Apple II during his moonlighting hours. When HP decided in 2010 to abandon its Cupertino campus, which was just about a mile east of Apple's One Infinite Loop headquarters, Jobs quietly arranged to buy it and the adjoining property. He admired the way that Hewlett and Packard had built a lasting company, and he prided himself on having done the same at Apple. Now he wanted a showcase headquarters, something that no West Coast technology company had. He eventually accumulated 150 acres, much of which had been apricot orchards when he was a boy, and threw himself into what would become a legacy project that combined his passion for design with his passion for creating an enduring company. "I want to leave a signature campus that expresses the values of the company for generations," he said. He hired what he considered to be the best architectural firm in the world, that of Sir Norman Foster, which had done smartly engineered buildings, such as the restored Reichstag in Berlin and 30 Simmeriaks in London. Not surprisingly, Jobs got so involved in the planning both the vision and the details, that it became almost impossible to settle on a final design. This was to be his lasting edifice, and he wanted to get it right. Foster's firm assigned 50 architects to the team, and every 3 weeks throughout 2010, they showed Jobs revised models and options. Over and over, he would come up with new concepts, sometimes entirely new shapes, and make them restart and provide more alternatives. When he first showed me the models and plans in his living room, the building was shaped like a huge winding racetrack made of three joined semicircles around a large central courtyard. The walls were floor-to-ceiling glass, and the interior had rows of office pods that allowed the sunlight to stream down the aisles. "It permits serendipitous and fluid meeting spaces," he said, "and everybody gets to participate in the sunlight." The next time he showed me the plans, a month later, we were in Apple's large conference room across from his office, where a model of the proposed building covered the table. He had made a major change. The pods would all be set back from the windows so that long corridors would be bathed in sun. These would also serve as the common spaces. There was a debate with some of the architects who wanted to allow the windows to be opened. Jobs had never liked the idea of people being able to open things. "That would just allow people to screw things up," he declared. On that, as on other details, he prevailed. When he got home that evening, Jobs showed off the drawings at dinner, and Reed joked that the aerial view reminded him of male genitalia. His father dismissed the comment as reflecting the mindset of a teenager. But the next day he mentioned the comment to the architects. "Unfortunately, once I've told you that, you're never going to be able to erase that image from your mind," he said. By the next time I visited, the shape had been changed to a simple circle. The new design meant there would not be a straight piece of glass in the building. All would be curved and seamlessly joined. Jobs had long been fascinated with glass, and his experience demanding huge custom panes for Apple's retail stores made him confident that it would be possible to make massive, curved pieces in quantity. The planned center courtyard was 800 feet across, more than three typical city blocks, or almost the length of three football fields, and he showed it to me with overlays indicating how it could surround St. Peter's Square in Rome. One of his lingering memories was of the orchards that had once dominated the area, so he hired a senior arborist from Stanford and decreed that 80% of the property would be landscaped in a natural manner with 6,000 trees. "I asked him to make sure to include a new set of apricot orchards," Jobs recalled. "You used to see them everywhere, even on the corners, and they're part of the legacy of this valley." By June 2011, the plans for the four-story, 3-million-square-foot building, which would hold more than 12,000 employees, were ready to unveil. He decided to do so in a quiet and unpublicized appearance before the Cupertino City Council, on the day after he had announced iCloud at the Worldwide Developers Conference. Even though he had little energy, he had a full schedule that day. Ron Johnson, who had developed Apple's stores and run them for more than a decade, had decided to accept an offer to be the CEO of JCPenney, and he came by Jobs's house in the morning to discuss his departure. Then Jobs and I went into Palo Alto to a small yogurt and oatmeal cafe called Fresh, where he talked animatedly about possible future Apple products. Later that day, he was driven to Santa Clara for the quarterly meeting that Apple had with top Intel executives, where they discussed the possibility of using Intel chips in future mobile devices. That night, U2 was playing at the Oakland Coliseum, and Jobs had considered going. Instead, he decided to use that evening to show his plans to the Cupertino Council. Arriving without an entourage or any fanfare, and looking relaxed in the same black sweater he had worn for his developers' conference speech, he stood on a podium with clicker in hand and spent 20 minutes showing slides of the design to council members. When a rendering of the sleek, futuristic, perfectly circular building appeared on the screen, he paused and smiled. "It's like a spaceship has landed," he said. A few moments later, he added, "I think we have a shot at building the best office building in the world." The following Friday, Jobs sent an email to a colleague from the distant past, Ann Bowers, the widow of Intel's co-founder, Bob Noyce. She had been Apple's human resources director and den mother in the early 1980s, in charge of reprimanding Jobs after his tantrums and tending to the wounds of his co-workers. Jobs asked if she would come see him the next day. Bowers happened to be in New York, but she came by his house that Sunday when she returned. By then, he was sick again, in pain and without much energy, but he was eager to show her the renderings of the new headquarters. "You should be proud of Apple," he said. "You should be proud of what we built." Then he looked at her and asked, intently, a question that almost floored her. "Tell me, what was I like when I was young?" Bowers tried to give him an honest answer. "You were very impetuous and very difficult," she replied, "but your vision was compelling. You told us, the journey is the reward. That turned out to be true." "Yes," Jobs answered, "I did learn some things along the way." Then a few minutes later, he repeated it as if to reassure Bowers and himself. "I did learn some things. I really did." Chapter 41, Round 3, A Never-Ending Struggle. Family Ties. Jobs had an aching desire to make it to his son's graduation from high school in June 2010. "When I was diagnosed with cancer, I made my deal with God or whatever, which was that I really wanted to see Reed graduate, and that got me through 2009," he said. As a senior, Reed looked eerily like his father at 18, with a knowing and slightly rebellious smile, intense eyes, and a shock of dark hair. But from his mother, he had inherited a sweetness and painfully sensitive empathy that his father lacked. He was demonstrably affectionate and eager to please. Whenever his father was sitting sullenly at the kitchen table and staring at the floor, which happened often when he was ailing, the only thing sure to cause his eyes to brighten was Reed walking in. Reed adored his father. "Soon after I started working on this book, he dropped in to where I was staying and, as his father often did, suggested we take a walk. He told me, with an intensely earnest look, that his father was not a cold, profit-seeking businessman, but was motivated by a love of what he did and a pride in the products he was making." After Jobs was diagnosed with cancer, Reed began spending his summers working in a Stanford oncology lab doing DNA sequencing to find genetic markers for colon cancer. In one experiment, he traced how mutations go through families. One of the very few silver linings about me getting sick is that Reed's gotten to spend a lot of time studying with some very good doctors, Jobs said. His enthusiasm for it is exactly how I felt about computers when I was his age. I think the biggest innovations of the 21st century will be the intersection of biology and technology. A new era is beginning, just like the digital one was when I was his age. Reed used his cancer study as the basis for the senior report he presented to his class at Crystal Springs Upland School. As he described how he used centrifuges and dyes to sequence the DNA of tumors, his father sat in the audience beaming, along with the rest of his family. "I fantasize about Reed getting a house here in Palo Alto with his family," and riding his bike to work as a doctor at Stanford, Jobs said afterward. Reed had grown up fast in 2009 when it looked as if his father was going to die. He took care of his younger sisters while his parents were in Memphis, and he developed a protective paternalism. But when his father's health stabilized in the spring of 2010, he regained his playful, teasing personality. One day during dinner, he was discussing with his family where to take his girlfriend for dinner. His father suggested Il Fornaio, an elegant standard in Palo Alto, but Reed said he had been unable to get reservations. "Do you want me to try?" his father asked. Reed resisted. He wanted to handle it himself. Aaron, the somewhat shy middle child, suggested that she could outfit a teepee in their garden, and she and Eve, the younger sister, would serve them a romantic meal there. Reed stood up and hugged her. He would take her up on that some other time, he promised. One Saturday, Reed was one of the four contestants on his school's Quiz Kids team, competing on a local TV station. The family, minus Eve, who was in a horse show, came to cheer him on. As the television crew bumbled around getting ready, his father tried to keep his impatience in check and remain inconspicuous among the parents sitting in the rows of folding chairs. But he was clearly recognizable in his trademark jeans and black turtleneck, and one woman pulled up a chair right next to him and started to take his picture. Without looking at her, he stood up and moved to the other end of the row. When Reed came on the set, his nameplate identified him as Reed Powell. The host asked the students what they wanted to be when they grew up. "A cancer researcher," Reed answered. Jobs drove his two-seat Mercedes SL55, taking Reed, while his wife followed in her own car with Aaron. On the way home, she asked Aaron why she thought her father refused to have a license plate on his car. "To be a rebel," she answered. I later put the question to Jobs. "Because people follow me sometimes, and if I have a license plate, they can track down where I live," he replied. "But that's kind of getting obsolete now with Google Maps, so I guess, really, it's just because I don't." During Reed's graduation ceremony, his father sent me an email from his iPhone that simply exulted, "Today is one of my happiest days. Reed is graduating from high school, right now, and against all odds, I am here." That night there was a party at their house with close friends and family. Reed danced with every member of his family, including his father. Later, Jobs took his son out to the barn-like storage shed to offer him one of his two bicycles, which he wouldn't be riding again. Reed joked that the Italian one looked a bit too gay, so Jobs told him to take the solid 8-speed next to it. When Reed said he would be indebted, Jobs answered, "You don't need to be indebted, because you have my DNA." A few days later, Toy Story 3 opened. Jobs had nurtured this Pixar trilogy from the beginning, and the final installment was about the emotion surrounding the departure of Andy for college. "I wish I could always be with you," Andy's mother says. "You always will be," he replies. Jobs' relationship with his two younger daughters was somewhat more distant. He paid less attention to Aaron, who was quiet, introspective, and seemed not to know exactly how to handle him, especially when he was emitting wounding barbs. She was a poised and attractive young woman with a personal sensitivity more mature than her father's. She thought that she might want to be an architect, perhaps because of her father's interest in the field, and she had a good sense of design. But when her father was showing Reed the drawings for the new Apple campus, she sat on the other side of the kitchen, and it seemed not to occur to him to call her over as well. Her big hope that spring of 2010 was that her father would take her to the Oscars. She loved the movies. Even more, she wanted to fly with her father on his private plane and walk up the red carpet with him. Powell was quite willing to forego the trip and tried to talk her husband into taking Aaron, but he dismissed the idea. At one point, as I was finishing this book, Powell told me that Aaron wanted to give me an interview. It's not something that I would have requested, since she was then just turning 16, but I agreed. The point Aaron emphasized was that she understood why her father was not always attentive, and she accepted that. He does his best to be both a father and the CEO of Apple, and he juggles those pretty well, she said. Sometimes I wish I had more of his attention, but I know the work he's doing is very important, and I think it's really cool, so I'm fine. I don't really need more attention. Jobs had promised to take each of his children on a trip of their choice when they became teenagers. Reed chose to go to Kyoto, knowing how much his father was entranced by the Zen calm of that beautiful city. Not surprisingly, when Aaron turned 13 in 2008, she chose Kyoto as well. Her father's illness caused him to cancel the trip, so he promised to take her in 2010 when he was better. But that June, he decided he didn't want to go. Aaron was crestfallen but didn't protest. Instead, her mother took her to France with family friends, and they rescheduled the Kyoto trip for July. Powell worried that her husband would again cancel, so she was thrilled when the whole family took off in early July for Kona Village, Hawaii, which was the first leg of the trip. But in Hawaii, Jobs developed a bad toothache, which he ignored, as if he could will the cavity away. The tooth collapsed and had to be fixed. Then the iPhone 4 antenna crisis hit, and he decided to rush back to Cupertino, taking Reed with him. Powell and Aaron stayed in Hawaii, hoping that Jobs would return and continue with the plans to take them to Kyoto. To their relief and mild surprise, Jobs actually did return to Hawaii after his press conference to pick them up and take them to Japan. "It's a miracle," Powell told a friend. While Reed took care of Eve back in Palo Alto, Aaron and her parents stayed at the Tawareya Ryokan, an inn of sublime simplicity that Jobs loved. "It was fantastic," Aaron recalled. 20 years earlier, Jobs had taken Aaron's half-sister, Lisa Brennan Jobs, to Japan when she was about the same age. Among her strongest memories was sharing with him delightful meals and watching him, usually such a picky eater, savor unagi, sushi, and other delicacies. Seeing him take joy in eating made Lisa feel relaxed with him for the first time. Aaron recalled a similar experience. "Dad knew where he wanted to go to lunch every day. He told me he knew an incredible soba shop, and he took me there. And it was so good that it's been hard to ever eat soba again, because nothing comes close." They also found a tiny neighborhood sushi restaurant, and Jobs tagged it on his iPhone as, "Best sushi I've ever had." Aaron agreed. They also visited Kyoto's famous Zen Buddhist temples. The one Aaron loved most was Saihoji, known as the Moss Temple because of its golden pond surrounded by gardens featuring more than 100 varieties of moss. Aaron was really, really happy, which was deeply gratifying and helped improve her relationship with her father, Powell recalled. She deserved that. Their younger daughter, Eve, was quite a different story. She was spunky, self-assured, and in no way intimidated by her father. Her passion was horseback riding, and she became determined to make it to the Olympics. When a coach told her how much work it would require, she replied, "Tell me exactly what I need to do. I will do it." He did, and she began diligently following the program. Eve was an expert at the difficult task of pinning her father down. She often called his assistant at work directly to make sure something got put on his calendar. She was also pretty good as a negotiator. One weekend in 2010, when the family was planning a trip, Erin wanted to delay the departure by half a day, but she was afraid to ask her father. Eve, then 12, volunteered to take on the task, and at dinner, she laid out the case to her father as if she were a lawyer before the Supreme Court. Jobs cut her off. "No, I don't think I want to." But it was clear that he was more amused than annoyed. Later that evening, Eve sat down with her mother and deconstructed the various ways that she could have made her case better. Jobs came to appreciate her spirit and see a lot of himself in her. "She's a pistol and has the strongest will of any kid I've ever met," he said. "It's like payback." He had a deep understanding of her personality, perhaps because it bore some resemblance to his. "Eve is more sensitive than a lot of people think," he explained. "She's so smart that she can roll over people a bit, so that means she can alienate people and she finds herself alone. She's in the process of learning how to be who she is, but tempers it around the edges so that she can have the friends that she needs." Jobs's relationship with his wife was sometimes complicated, but always loyal. Savvy and compassionate, Laureen Powell was a stabilizing influence and an example of his ability to compensate for some of his selfish impulses by surrounding himself with strong-willed and sensible people. She weighed in quietly on business issues, firmly on family concerns, and fiercely on medical matters. Early in their marriage, she co-founded and launched College Track, a national after-school program that helps disadvantaged kids graduate from high school and get into college. Since then, she had become a leading force in the education reform movement. Jobs professed an admiration for his wife's work. "What she's done with College Track really impresses me." But he tended to be generally dismissive of philanthropic endeavors and never visited her after-school centers. In February 2010, Jobs celebrated his 55th birthday with just his family. The kitchen was decorated with streamers and balloons, and his kids gave him a red velvet toy crown, which he wore. Now that he had recovered from a grueling year of health problems, Powell hoped that he would become more attentive to his family. But for the most part, he resumed his focus on his work. "I think it was hard on the family, especially the girls," she told me. "After 2 years of him being ill, he finally gets a little better, and they expected he would focus a bit on them, but he didn't." She wanted to make sure, she said, that both sides of his personality were reflected in this book and put into context. Like many great men whose gifts are extraordinary, he's not extraordinary in every realm, she said. He doesn't have social graces, such as putting himself in other people's shoes, but he cares deeply about empowering humankind, the advancement of humankind, and putting the right tools in their hands.